A Vindication of the Rights of Woman by Mary Wollstonecraft, first published in 1792. Chapters 6 and 7. This reading is based on a text at the website www.earlymoderntexts.com. Reader, Mill Nicholson. Chapter 6. The Effect That an Early Association of Ideas Has on the Character. Given that they are educated in the enervating style recommended by the writers I have been criticising, and are deprived by their subordinate social status from recovering their lost ground, is it surprising that women everywhere appear to be a defect in nature? When we consider what a definite effect an early association of ideas has on the character, is it surprising that women neglect their understandings and turn all their attention to their persons, their physical appearance? Storing the mind with knowledge, naturally, brings great advantages, as is obvious from the following considerations. The association of our ideas is either habitual or instantaneous, and instantaneous association seems to depend on the mind's basic contents rather than on the will. When the ideas and matters of fact are once taken in, they are stored for subsequent use, until some chance happening makes the information dart into the mind with illustrative force, this being information that has been received at very different periods of our lives. Many recollections are like lightning. One idea assimilates and explains another with astonishing rapidity. I am not now talking about the quick perception of truth, which is so intuitive that it baffles research, and leaves us at a loss to discover whether what has opened the dark cloud is reminiscence, or else thinking that we don't detect because of its speed. Over those instantaneous associations we have little power. When the mind is enriched in some way, the raw materials will, to some extent, arrange themselves. The understanding, it is true, may help us to keep us in order when we group our thoughts or transcribe from the imagination the warm sketches of fancy. But the animal spirits, the individual character, give the colouring. These spirits are a kind of superfine electric fluid over which we have little power, and our reason has little control over that power. These fine, intractable spirits appear to be the essence of genius, and shining in its eagle eye, they produce in the highest degree the happy energy of associating thoughts that surprise, delight, and instruct. These are the glowing minds that concentrate pictures for their fellow creatures, forcing them to take an interest in objects reflected from the impassioned imagination, objects that they hadn't attended to in nature. Let me explain. Most people cannot see or feel poetically. They lack imagination. So they fly from solitude in search of objects they can see or feel. But when an author lends them his eyes, they can see as he saw, and be entertained by images that they couldn't select for themselves, although the images were lying before them. Education thus only supplies the man of genius with knowledge to give variety and contrast to his associations. But there is an habitual association of ideas that develops along with us, and has a great effect on the moral character of mankind. Such associations give the mind a slant that commonly remains throughout life. The understanding is so ductile, and yet so stubborn, that the associations that depend on external events before the body arrives at maturity can seldom be disentangled by reason. One idea calls up another, its old associate, and memory retraces them with mechanical exactness. Memory is faithful to the first impressions, especially when the intellectual powers are not employed to cool our sensations. This habitual slavery to first impressions has a more harmful effect on the female character than on the male, because business and other dry employments of the understanding tend to deaden the feelings and break associations that do violence to reason. But females, who are turned into women when they are mere children, and brought back to childhood when they ought to leave the go-cart forever, haven't enough strength of mind to erase the overlay of art that has smothered nature. Everything they see or hear serves to fix impressions, call up emotions, and link ideas, giving the mind its feminine character. And the first idea associations that are forced on them by every surrounding object are allowed to run wild instead of being examined. Given how females are educated, how could they attain the vigour that is needed to be able to free themselves from the character traits that have been constructed for them? Where could they find the strength to resort to reason and rise above a system of oppression that blasts the fair promises of spring? This cruel association of ideas, which everything conspires to twist into all their habits of thinking, or more accurately, of feeling, receives new force when they begin to act a little for themselves. For that's when they see that their only route to pleasure and power is through their skill in arousing emotions in men. Besides, the first impressions on their minds come from books that offer to instruct them, and they all teach the same lessons. It is unreasonable, as well as cruel, to scold women for faults that they, educated as they are in worse than Egyptian bondage, can hardly avoid, unless there are some who have a degree of native vigour that very few among mankind are blessed with. For instance, the severest sarcasms have been levelled against the sex. For example, Swift ridicules them for repeating a set of phrases learnt by rote. Yet nothing could be more natural than that, considering the education they receive and the widespread opinion that, in Milton's words, their highest praise is to obey, unargued, the will of man. If they aren't allowed to have enough reason to govern their own conduct, then of course everything they learn must be learned by rote. If Pope's summary of their character is just, namely, that every woman is at heart a rake, why should they be bitterly censured for seeking a congenial companion and preferring a rake to a man of sense? Rakes know how to work on women's feelings, while the modest merit of reasonable men has less effect on their feelings, and can't reach their heart via the understanding, because they, men and women, have few sentiments in common. It seems a little absurd to deny women the uncontrolled use of their reason, while still expecting them to be more reasonable than men in their likings. When do men fall in love with sense? When do they, with their superior powers and advantages, turn from the physical appearance to the mind? And how can they then expect women, who are only taught to observe behaviour and to acquire manners rather than morals, to despise what they have spent their lives struggling to acquire? Where are they suddenly to find judgment enough to weigh patiently the good sense of an awkward, virtuous man, when his conversation is cold and dull, because it doesn't consist of pretty repartees or well-turned compliments? In order to admire or esteem anything for long, we must at least have our curiosity aroused by knowing something about it. We can't estimate the value of qualities and virtues that are above our comprehension. When such a respect is felt, it may be very sublime, and the admiring woman's confused feeling of humility may have some tendency to make her attractive to others. But human love must also have cruder ingredients, and the woman's physical appearance, very naturally, will come in for its share. And what a big share it usually is! Love is to a large extent an arbitrary passion, and, like some other stalking mischiefs, it will reign by its own authority, without bringing in reason. And it's easy to distinguish love from esteem, the foundation of friendship, because love is often aroused by fleeting beauties and graces, though love won't have much energy unless something more solid deepens the impression made by those beauties and graces, setting the imagination to work to make the loveliest the best. Common passions are aroused by common qualities. Men look for beauty, and the simper of good-humoured docility. Women are captivated by easy manners. A gentlemanly man seldom fails to please them, and their thirsty ears eagerly drink in the suggestive nothings of politeness, while they turn away from the unintelligible sounds of the other charmer, reason, however wisely he produces his charm. When it comes to superficial accomplishments, the rake certainly has the advantage. and females can form an opinion about these because this is their own ground. When they are rendered gay and giddy by the whole tenor of their lives, the very look of wisdom or of the severe graces of virtue must strike them as gloomy, and produce a kind of restraint from which they naturally revolt, as does love, that playful child. Without taste, which is the offspring of judgment, how can they learn that true beauty and grace must arise from the play of the mind? And how can they be expected to enjoy in a lover something that they so very imperfectly possess themselves? The sympathy that unites hearts and invites to confidence is so very faint in them that it can't catch fire and thus rise to the level of passion. No, I repeat it, the love cherished by such minds must have cruder fuel. The conclusion is obvious. Until women are led to exercise their understandings, they shouldn't be satirized for their attachment to rakes, nor even for being rakes at heart themselves, when that seems to be the inevitable consequence of their education. Those who live to please must find their enjoyments, their happiness, in pleasure. We never do anything well unless we love it for its own sake. A trite remark, but a true one. Pretend for a moment that at some future time women were to become what I sincerely wish them to be. Then love would acquire a more serious dignity, and be purified in its own fires. And because virtue would give true delicacy to women's affections, they would turn with disgust from a rake. When that time came, they would reason as well as feel, whereas feeling is all they can do at present, so that it would be easy for them to guard against surface graces, and learn to despise the sensibility whose trade is vice, allurement, and wanton airs. They would recollect that the flame they wanted to light up had been exhausted by lust, and that the sated appetite, losing all taste for pure and simple pleasures, could be aroused only by licentious arts of variety. What satisfaction could a woman of delicacy promise herself in a union with such a man, when the very artlessness, the straightforward sincerity of her affection might appear insipid? One grand truth women haven't yet learned, though it would do them a lot of good if they acted on it, namely, in the choice of a husband, they should not be led astray by the qualities of a lover, because even a wise and virtuous husband can't remain a lover for long. If women were more rationally educated, and could take a more comprehensive view of things, they would be content to love only once in their lives, and after marriage calmly let passion subside into friendship, into that tender intimacy which is the best refuge from care. Friendship is built on such pure, calm affections that idle jealousies aren't allowed to disturb the performance of the sober duties of life, or occupy the thoughts that ought to be otherwise employed. This is a state in which many men live, but very few women. It is easy to explain this difference without supposing that there are basic, natural psychological differences between the sexes. I have frequently seen this exemplified in women whose beauty could no longer be repaired. They have retired from the noisy scenes of dissipation, but unless they became Methodists, the solitude of the select society of their family connections or acquaintance has presented only a fearful void, so that they became quite as useless as they were when they joined the giddy throng, equally useless and far more unhappy. End of chapter 6. Chapter 7. Modesty, considered comprehensively and not as a sexual virtue. Modesty, sacred offspring of sensibility and reason, true delicacy of mind. I hope you won't blame me if I investigate your nature and study the mild charm that makes lovely something that would otherwise only inspire cold admiration. You who smooth wisdom's wrinkles and soften the tone of the more elevated virtues until they all melt into humanity. You who spread the ethereal cloud that encircles love and heightens every beauty that it half shades. Help me to shape the language of persuasive reason, so that I can rouse my sex from the flowery bed on which they supinely sleep life away. In defining modesty, we should distinguish the purity of mind that is an effect of chastity from a simplicity of character, that leads us to form a just opinion of ourselves, not vain or presumptuous, but compatible with an awareness of our own dignity. Modesty, in the second sense, is a soberness of mind that teaches a man not to think more highly of himself than he ought to think. It should be distinguished from humility, because humility is a kind of self-abasement. A modest man often conceives a great plan, and tenaciously sticks to it, conscious of his own strength, until it is crowned with success. Milton was not arrogant when he let slip a judgment that proved to be a prophecy, nor was General Washington arrogant when he accepted the command of the American forces. Washington has always been described as a modest man, but if he had been merely humble, he would probably have shrunk back, afraid of trusting to himself the direction of an enterprise on which so much depended. A modest man is steady, a humble man is timid, and a vain one is presumptuous, or so my observation of many characters has led me to believe. Jesus Christ was modest, Moses was humble, and the Apostle Peter was vain. Modesty is different not only from humility, but also from bashfulness. Bashfulness is so distinct from modesty, indeed, that the most bashful lass or raw country lout often becomes the most impudent, for their bashfulness is merely the instinctive timidity of ignorance, and custom soon changes it into assurance. The shameless behaviour of the prostitutes who infest the streets of London, causing alternate emotions of pity and disgust, illustrate this remark. They trample on virgin bashfulness with a sort of bravado, and glorying in their shame, they become more audaciously lewd than men ever appear to be. But these poor ignorant wretches never had any modesty to lose when they consigned themselves to infamy, for modesty is a virtue, not a quality. No, they were only bashful, shamefaced innocents, and when they lost their innocence, their shamefacedness was roughly brushed off to disappear without a trace, whereas if passion had led them to lose a virtue, the virtue would have left some traces in their minds, and we could have respected the ruins of it. Purity of mind, i.e., the genuine delicacy that is the only virtuous support of chastity, is something nobler than innocence. It is the delicacy of reflection, and not the coyness of ignorance. The reservedness of reason, which is seldom seen in any great degree unless the soul is active, can easily be distinguished from rustic shyness or wanton skittishness, and far from being incompatible with knowledge, it is its fairest fruit. Someone who wrote this had a gross idea of modesty. The lady who asked, "Can women be instructed in the modern system of botany consistently with female delicacy?" was accused of ridiculous prudery. But if she had asked me, I would certainly have answered, "No, they cannot." So the fair book of knowledge is to be shut with an everlasting seal. On reading things like that, I have reverentially lifted up my eyes and heart to God and said, "Oh, my Father, have you by the very constitution of my nature forbidden me to seek you in the fair forms of truth?" A woman who has dedicated much of her time to purely intellectual pursuits, and whose affections have been put to work in humane plans of usefulness, must, as a natural consequence, have more purity of mind than the ignorant beings whose time and thoughts have been occupied by gay pleasures or schemes to conquer hearts. I have conversed with medical men on anatomical subjects, conversing as man with man, and I have discussed the proportions of the human body with male artists, but I was treated with such modesty that I was never reminded by word or look of my sex, or of the absurd rules that make modesty a pharisaical cloak for weakness. And I am convinced that in the pursuit of knowledge, women would never be insulted by sensible men, and rarely by men of any kind, if they didn't, by mock modesty, remind them that they were women. Men are not always men in the company of women, and women wouldn't always remember that they are women if they were allowed to acquire more understanding. the regulation of one's behaviour is not modesty, though those who carefully obey rules of decorum are generally described as modest women. Make the heart clean. Let it expand and feel for everything human instead of being narrowed by selfish passions. And let the mind frequently contemplate subjects that exercise the understanding without heating the imagination, and artless modesty will give the finishing touches to the picture. Anyone who sees herself as a mortal will respect, as a sacred temple, the body that enshrines such an improvable soul. True love also spreads this kind of mysterious sanctity around the beloved object, making the lover most modest when in her presence. As a sex, women are more chaste than men, and as modesty is the effect of chastity, they may deserve to have this virtue, modesty, ascribed to them. But I must be allowed to add a hesitating if, revising the above statement to if modesty is the effect of chastity, because I am not sure whether chastity will produce modesty, though it may produce propriety of conduct, when it is merely a respect for the opinion of the world. The immodest behaviour of many married women, who are nevertheless faithful to their husbands' beds, will illustrate this remark. Indeed, my experience and my reason lead me to expect to find more modesty among men than among women, simply because men exercise their understandings more than women do. But when it comes to propriety of behaviour, women obviously have the advantage, except for one class of females. What can be more disgusting than that impudent dross of gallantry, thought to be so manly, which makes many men stare insultingly at every female they meet? Is this respect for the sex? No. This loose behaviour shows such habitual depravity, such weakness of mind, that we can't expect to see much public or private virtue until both men and women grow more modest and treat each other with more respect. I mean the modest respect of humanity and fellow feeling, not the libidinous mockery of gallantry or the insolent condescension of protectorship. The sexual distinction respecting modesty is carried still further, and woman, weak woman, whose education has made her the slave of sensibility, is required on the most difficult occasions to resist that sensibility. "Can anything," says Knox, "be more absurd than keeping women in a state of ignorance and yet vehemently insisting that they resist temptation?" Thus, when virtue or honour make it proper to check a passion, the burden is thrown on the weaker shoulders, contrary to reason and true modesty, which should at least make the self-denial mutual. When men boast of their victories over women, what are they boasting of? Truly the creature of sensibility was surprised by her sensibility into folly, into vice, and the dreadful reckoning falls heavily on her own weak head, when reason wakes. Where will you find comfort, forlorn and disconsolate one? The man who ought to have directed your reason and supported your weakness has betrayed you. In a dream of passion, you consented to wander through flowery lawns, and, carelessly stepping over the precipice to which your guide lured you, you awake from your dream, and find yourself faced by a sneering, frowning world. You are alone in a wasteland, for the man who triumphed in your weakness is now pursuing new conquests. But for you, there is no redemption on this side of the grave. But if the sexes are really to live in a state of warfare, if that's what nature has indicated, then let men act nobly, or let pride whisper to them that when they merely conquer sensibility, that is a tawdry victory. They have a real victory when they conquer affection in open battle, not taking it by surprise, when, like Eloise, a woman deliberately gives up all the world for love. I am not discussing the wisdom or virtue of such a sacrifice. I merely contend that it was a sacrifice to affection and not merely to sensibility, though she had her share of that. I call her a modest woman. Now for another view of the subject, this time purely about women. Mistaken notions of modesty lead people to tell children ridiculous falsehoods, that tend very early to inflame their imaginations, and set their little minds to work on topics that nature never intended them to think about until their bodies arrived at some degree of maturity. At that stage, the passions naturally begin to take over the role of the senses in unfolding the understanding and forming the moral character. Children very early see cats with their kittens, birds with their young, etc. Then why shouldn't they be told that their mothers carry and nourish them in the same way? As there would be no appearance of mystery, they wouldn't give any more thought to the subject. Truth can always be told to children, if it is told gravely. But it is the immodesty of affected modesty that does all the harm. It is a smoke that vainly tries to obscure certain objects, but only succeeds in heating the imagination. If indeed children could be kept entirely from improper company, we need never talk to them about such subjects. But as this is impossible, it is best to tell them the truth, especially as such information won't impress itself on their imaginations, because they won't be much interested in it. Girls are first spoiled in nurseries and boarding schools, especially the latter. A number of girls sleep in the same room and wash together. I wouldn't want to contaminate an innocent creature's mind by instilling false delicacy or the indecent prudish notions that naturally arise from early cautions regarding the other sex, but I would be very anxious to prevent their acquiring nasty or immodest habits, and as many girls have learned very nasty tricks from ignorant servants, it is very improper to mix the girls indiscriminately with the servants. The fact is that women are in general too familiar with each other, which leads to that gross degree of familiarity that so frequently renders the marriage state unhappy. Why are sisters, female intimates, or ladies and their waiting women, so grossly familiar as to forget the respect that one human creature owes to another? The squeamish delicacy that shrinks from disgusting tasks when affection or humanity lead us to care for a sick person is despicable. But why are healthy women more familiar with each other than men are, when they, the women, boast of their greater delicacy? I have never been able to answer this. In order to preserve health and beauty, I earnestly recommend frequent ablutions. I'm putting this in words that won't offend the fastidious ear. And girls ought to be taught to wash and dress alone. And if they need some little assistance, they shouldn't ask for it until they have finished that part of the business that ought never to be done before a fellow creature, because it is an insult to the majesty of human nature. Not because of modesty, but because of decency. I need hardly add that I consider as immodest all those airs of grown women to which truth is sacrificed to secure the heart of a husband, or rather to force him to be still a lover, when nature, if left alone, would have replaced love for him by friendship with him. The tenderness that a man will feel for the mother of his children is an excellent substitute for the ardour of unsatisfied passion. But it is indelicate, not to say immodest, for a woman to prolong that ardour by feigning an unnatural coldness of constitution. Women, as well as men, ought to have the common appetites and passions of their nature. They are animal-like only when not controlled by reason. But the obligation to control them is the duty of mankind, not of one sex rather than the other. In these respects, nature can safely be left to itself. Let women acquire knowledge and humanity, and love will teach them modesty. There is no need for disgusting and futile falsehoods, because calculated rules of behaviour deceive only shallow observers. A man of sense soon sees through such an affectation and despises it. My sisters, if you really want to possess modesty, you must remember that the possession of any virtue is incompatible with ignorance and vanity. You must acquire the soberness of mind that can only come from the performance of duties and the pursuit of knowledge. Without it, you will remain in a doubtful, dependent situation, and you will be loved only while you are beautiful. The downcast eye, the rosy blush, the retiring grace, are all proper in their season. But modesty is the child of reason, and can't coexist for long with the sensibility that is not tempered by reflection. Besides, if you devote your lives to love, even innocent love, your hearts will be too soft to provide for modesty the tranquil retreat where she delights to dwell in close union with humanity. End of chapter 7.